Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Kurt Nikisch. The color orange dominates the headquarters of the marketing software company HubSpot. There are orange couches, orange soda fountains, even orange phone booths. This former furniture factory has been redesigned with kitchens and meeting rooms and nooks where workers can brainstorm and innovate.
This is our lounge slash company meeting area slash whatever we need it for.
Company co-founder Dharmesh Shah shows off one meeting space.
The requisite startup, beer fridge, ping pong table, and foosball table.
Table tennis and foosball may be requisite at an innovative tech company nowadays, but being successful at innovation is much more than that, says our guest today. Beneath all those fun, positive things on the surface, you have to learn hard truths, make disciplined choices, and face harsh realities. And that, he says, is where most companies and leaders get innovation wrong. Our guest today is Gary Pisano. He is a professor at Harvard Business School, and he's the author of the HBR article, The Hard Truth About Innovative Cultures. He's also the author of a new book, Creative Construction, The DNA of Sustained Innovation. Gary, thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be here.
You spend a lot of time as a researcher and advisor at both small entrepreneurial companies and large companies trying to do innovation at scale. What misperception about innovation at scale do companies and managers have that you want to disabuse here?
Well, there's a few. For years in my work on innovation, I'd be, you know, in teaching executive programs and running seminars, you always do something on culture, and you do the standard cases like IDEO, and they talk about startups and they show, you know, foosball tables, and these environments seemed like a lot of fun.
Right.
And they're not necessarily fun environments. They're extremely intense environments.
Right.
And if I asked people what they thought an innovative culture was, they would list to me a set of attributes, things like tolerance for failure, willingness to experiment, freedom to speak up, collaborative. And then I would ask, so how many of you want to work in an environment like this? And just about everybody raises their hand.
Yeah.
These sound like great environments.
Right.
And then I'd ask, how many of you do work in an environment like that? And very few people would raise their hands. And that was puzzling, because what they had described were a set of organizational attributes that not only seemed to be good for the company, it seemed to be something they'd want to do. So I said, wait, there's something wrong here. This is, normally cultural change is hard if you're asking people to do something unpleasant.
Right. But if you're trying to push them down the hill.
Yeah, exactly. This is like stuff people seem to all want to do. So why isn't it happening? What really struck me was that, in fact, innovative cultures, yes, they required this set of fairly palatable behaviors that people wanted to embrace, and things like willingness to experiment and so forth. But there was this other side as equally important, but in some sense, it's much harder, much tougher. Much less pleasant. And unless you embraced both, you really didn't have an innovative culture. And I think by focusing so much of the effort on the pleasant side of things, this kind of willingness to experiment and speaking up and collaborative, what would happen is organizations—
Celebrate failure.
And we could talk more about that cliche.
Yeah.
Another one that annoys me to death. When they would hit the reality of something different, then people became very skeptical to say, oh, no, well, the senior management didn't mean all that. But in fact, I think it represented a fairly deep misunderstanding of what was going to be required to have an innovative culture. It wasn't going to just be all this sort of fun stuff. It was going to be a set of tougher things as well together.
So let's start maybe with this cliche of celebrate failure, right? What's wrong with that?
Well, the job isn't to celebrate. You want to celebrate the learning that comes from failure, not celebrating the failure. There's productive failures and there's unproductive failures. And you want to judge failures in terms of how much you learn. So if you try something new and it's risky and it doesn't work, so it quote unquote fails, but you've now learned something about the path forward that could be attractive, that's worth celebrating the learning from that. If you just came up with a bad design or did sloppy work and it failed, that's not worth celebrating. The focus has got to be on the learning, not the failure.
You wrote the sentence and it really stood out. The truth is that a tolerance for failure requires having extremely competent people, right? This is where you were saying, you know, if we messed up because it was a bad design or shoddy decision making or whatever, that's not something to celebrate.
Exactly.
And incompetence, essentially, is what you're talking about there.
Yeah. I mean, these companies have high tolerance for failure, but they have low tolerance for incompetence. If you look at companies like Google, they set extraordinarily high performance standards, extraordinarily high. It's very, very, very hard to get a job at Google.
Yeah, you had a statistic of, I forget how many interviews they do for just a few,
several million for a couple of thousand jobs. Right. I mean, it's impossible to get a job at Google.
Right. And then I think the thing is that people don't see that part of it.
That's right.
That is a design, where you have a huge, very disciplined, high standard for bringing people into the company, and then you give them lots of freedom.
That's
and
right.
And then you give them the 20%, and then you give...
That's right, because you're sure you've got... And this is where they're synergistic. Then you're much more likely to tolerate kind of experimentation and recognize the potential value of learning from a failure if you know the people you've got are super competent and that they're not messing up because they didn't think things through or they're designing sloppy experiments or they're... But that they're actually kind of pushing the envelope. That's why you need super competent people. And again, in a lot of larger companies, what became clear very quickly is they had fairly high tolerance for mediocre performance. People who weren't up to the task were, shuffled around the different departments, but they were there, and that's destructive.
So companies that don't have this stage gate that Google has, what can they do to really ensure competence?
The first is setting the right bar on hiring. Look, today we have lots of advanced tools and technologies for helping us innovate. We have big data analytics, et cetera. But innovation is probably the most intensely human activity we have today, despite all the technology that helps us.
Yeah.
So if you're really serious about being an innovator, then your most scarce resource and your most important resource are your human resources. So if you set out to say, we want to be an innovative company, but we don't have or we don't think we can create an A-plus team of people, you're just fantasizing. You really need great people. And so that should become your number one priority. How do we attract them? How are we paying them? How are we retaining them? What kind of environment?
And that's not going to happen overnight.
And the problem is, if you're a company who's got a reputation for mediocrity, you're not going to attract the AP. Why do all my best students, they all want to go to Google. They all want to go to Apple. They all want to go to Amazon. They don't want to go to Sears. Smaller companies can do that. They can lure people with the excitement of what's going on. They can financially lure people with stock options. If you're a company who's been struggling, I think it starts with boards, making sure you're getting in really strong people at the top. If you're going to turn a company around.
Right. It's like getting the head coach who can recruit.
Exactly. But also making performance standards really clear and then having clarity around the consequences for low performance. And again, that's tough. So if you've been in an environment where people tended not to be held accountable for their performance and bad judgment calls or sloppy design work or sloppy thinking, and now you start to impose that, that's a lot less fun. Because suddenly people are not promoted. People don't get their bonuses. People are, terminated. This is the tough side. That's why, we called the article the hard side of innovative cultures. Yeah. It's hard. There's a rougher edge to it. It's not pleasant. It's not, it's not all foosball tables and fun.
Yeah, that is the problem with that image, is that we're having a good time and through that kind of positive environment, good things are just going to happen. And you're saying here that there's tough decisions that go behind that freedom.
Yeah. I mean, most startups do fail. So most of the people who work for them lose their jobs. I mean, it's yeah. brutal.
Yeah. What's a good example of a company that takes the consequences for low performance seriously?
Amazon's a great example. And they've sometimes been criticized, you know, for being a very tough environment and terminating people and having a very rigorous performance evaluation system. You know, again, I think that's just part of the deal of being an innovative culture. They have to have outstanding people. They hold people accountable. So strong accountability is part of it. Individuals are accountable, not groups, not teams, but individuals. And, you know, you have to strike the right balance. You don't want environments to be cruel and you don't want them to be capricious. But Amazon's an example. Look, Steve Jobs was famous, notorious for firing people who weren't up to the task.
Yeah, right.
And
without a lot of second chances.
Without a lot of second chances.
Yeah.
One thing I tell people and I go around rooms is being in a highly innovative organization may not be for you individually as I go around the room. Now, some of you may be really uncomfortable and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we shouldn't make a value judgment. That is, some people don't want to be in organizations with high individual accountability. Some people don't want to be in organizations where... you know, there's going to be really tough performance consequences.
Yep.
And that's okay. I don't want to make judgments about the kind of work environments people should be in. I think there's lots of different kinds of work environments for different folks. And the goal is to find the one that fits with you. So for leaders, they have to clarify, here's the real road ahead.
Another hard truth, your observation that companies need to have a willingness to experiment, but be highly disciplined about it.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, we know that innovation, particularly transformative innovation, requires experimentation. You can't plan everything in advance.
You don't know what's going to happen.
You don't know what's going to happen. So you want to experiment. And we've heard this, you know, for decades now about, you know, experiment. But what really great innovative companies do is they're very disciplined about listening to the data they're getting from the experiment and then acting on it. And that often means killing the project or stopping or doing what is generally called the killer experiment in science, which is you set up the experiment to say, this experiment gives us the best chance to show this doesn't work. By the way, that's a problem in startups as well as big companies. Everybody wants to do the experiment that shows, this is worth continuing, but that's not productive. The more productive approach requires the discipline of setting up an experiment, which essentially tortures the idea so that early on it says, that one is not going to work as we thought, but here's another idea. But that requires a tremendous amount of discipline as opposed to what happens when you get experimental results and you say, well, but there's maybe another way we can, let's keep going. Let's try another experiment. People put spin on it. You have to take the data as being sacred and make judgment calls, tough judgment calls to kill projects. And that doesn't make people happy when it was their project.
Yeah. This strikes me as incredibly hard because there are so many examples of teams of scientists at biotech companies that were developing a drug. The company thought it should be killed. They ended up taking it outside, licensing it, yep, moving it ahead, and then, you know, coming up with a breakthrough therapy.
That's right. There's lots of folklore. I mean, these things which were killed a dozen times, which went on to become, you know, $3 billion drugs or $10 billion drugs, become
right,
the kind of lore of the industry. And everybody, every time somebody's about to kill a project, they say, well, it could be this.
Yeah, yeah.
It could be another one of those.
Right.
And it could be.
There are also examples of
the other
things that are taken too far. Yeah.
And so you never know. You're always balancing kind of type one, type two errors in this kind of thing. Am I killing a winner or keeping a loser going? But that's why really disciplined experimentation is key, because actually really good experiments give you better data. They don't make the decision for you and you're still gonna have to use judgment call.
I love this idea of the killer experiment, right? And that goes with the ability to criticize almost brutally, right?
Yep.
To have that willingness to do that.
Yep.
At the same time, you want, I mean, Amy Edmondson, your colleague, has a book about the fearless organization, right? She,
yep,
wants the psychological safety in organizations so that people can do great things.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the hard truth of this environment where you want people to be able to criticize but also feel great about what they're doing?
Right. So it's the delicate balance. And I've got a huge respect for Amy's work. We've talked together. We've worked together. And so I'm a big believer in what she writes about psychological safety. But psychological safety doesn't mean you can't have people being extremely candid.
Her original idea, what she had found, is that people who were able to talk about mistakes and talk about their learning,
right,
ended up being more effective.
That's right. That's right. And so I don't think these ideas are in conflict at all. It often gets misinterpreted as, you know, there's a willingness to speak up, but then that goes two ways. It's, if I can speak up and be critical, of your ideas, then I've got to be willing to accept the criticism of my ideas.
Right.
And so as a result in these organizations where people are free to speak up, when you sit around the table, you realize, wow, these are pretty tough places. I mean, you got to have a thick skin. I've sat through many of these meetings and you see people kind of really getting at it. Now, the key is it's about the idea. It's about the data. It's about the concept. It's not about you. It's no fun to get challenged. It's no fun to the idea that you've been working on for months that you think is great to have people rip it apart.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily comfortable organizations to be in. That's a reality. I think you need that for innovation.
Is that especially hard at large companies?
I think so, because some companies confuse this idea of like respect. My research that I came across at one company, somebody sort of confided to me about their company culture, which is we're just too nice. Mm. Like it's considered you're not a team player if you start to challenge somebody at a meeting.
I know lots of companies like that.
Yeah. And it's like, and this is not about psychological safety per se. It's not like people felt unsafe to speak up. They actually don't feel it's the right thing to do. Now, to me, that's a huge problem. What tends to happen is that criticism occurs, but it occurs in the hallway. It occurs on the walk out to the parking lot. It's,
right.
Hey, you know, let me tell you a little bit about, you know, what I really thought on the side. And that's problematic because I think it creates a very toxic culture. But also you lose information because there's conversations occurring in the hallway, which if we all had them around a table, we could then say, wait a minute, no, that actually your data is problematic. But here's a better way maybe we can look at it. Or maybe it's not so problematic. I mean, we can learn and that's what you get out. But that's a willingness to sort of expose your idea and to really take, you know, sometimes take a beating.
Yeah.
Figuratively.
Which gets to another truth of yours about innovative cultures, and that is having collaboration, but also individual accountability.
That's right.
And this is really tough because I think there is a sense that if you go work at some of these places or highly collaborative places, that there has to be a we did it end to it all, and that rewards don't necessarily get pinned on individual people, but also like punishment doesn't get pinned on individual people. Mm-hmm. Sounds like you're not a fan of that.
I'm not a fan of that at all. I like the one neck rule, as they say. Again, let's think about what's key for innovation. We know speed is really important for innovation, speed of decision making. Individuals can make decisions faster than committees. I know this being an academic. Individuals, though, again, this is the balance. As a manager or project leader, if you're being held individually accountable, you have a lot of incentive to collaborate. You will get input from a lot of different folks.
Mm-hmm.
So to some extent, that accountability drives collaboration. Where I see collaboration breaking down is where everybody has their own sub-goals. Like this group wants to protect its turf and this group wants to protect its turf. Where when individuals have their careers on the line, their jobs on the line, their bonus on the line, they have every incentive to make sure they're getting input from the right sets of people and driving the appropriate kinds of collaboration. And I think the problem becomes when you start to get groups involved or, you know, collaboration can quickly degenerate into consensus. They're slow. And you don't make hard decisions. You kind of make mediocre decisions. You know, you can't decide between chocolate and vanilla, so you do swirl. You know, you just kind of get some compromises. We've all seen products like that that look like they were designed by committees.
Yep.
Rather than somebody making a judgment call and saying, we got to choose. It's going to be A or B. Everything I've learned after taking into account the judgment of a lot of different people, a lot of different data, some of you favored A, some of you favored B. Here's why I'm doing A. I think that's much more effective. And then you're telling that person, I trust your judgment. And we're going to hold you accountable for your judgment. You've got to make good judgments. That's what we expect leaders to do. If you've got leaders who can't make good judgments, they're in the wrong position.
Yeah. This is where this bleeds into startup culture, where organizations are often flatter, right? Mm-hmm. They're designed that way to try to leverage input from everybody and to make sure that product knows what marketing's doing, et cetera, et cetera. But that still requires leadership, it sounds like.
It does, because leadership sets the boundaries. You can be flat if you've got really clear direction. If you're very decentralized, I mean, that's another way to think about flatness, but everybody's off going off doing their own thing, or there's no clear agreement on the vision or the direction we're going to go, then it degenerates into chaos. So strong leaders set boundaries around, here's the direction we're going, here's the top priorities. Now I'm going to let you decide how you go after it, but here's the priority. That's what the leader has to provide, is that kind of clarity.
And that gets lost.
That often can get lost, right? So sometimes in flatness, we're losing that. We're kind of delegating decisions that should not be delegated, that that we're creating confusion.
Yeah. What I like about this is that you're showing that innovation and sustained innovation is, you know, phenomenally hard to do. But if you do it, that also gives you competitive advantage.
Huge.
Like if it were easy, everybody would be doing it and you'd be in the same boat as everybody else.
Exactly. It's valuable precisely because it's so hard. And what I promise it both, I think in the article and in the book is that, look, I'm hoping to make this really tough journey a little easier for you, but it's not easy. And just being prepared for that, I think, is helpful. And this is a kind of guideline to get in. And there is this tough side. We talked about the balance. And the way I've described it is the kind of fun side, the kind of tolerance for failure and the, you know, freedom to speak up and willingness to experiment and so forth. That's kind of like the ice cream side. But there's this other side. Maybe I'm dating myself a little bit. But when I was little, you know, you'd get cod liver oil less for health. Yeah, that's I am.
Yeah.
That fish oil, which I guess we know today is good for you. That's nasty stuff. So it's a little like saying, guess what? You get to have your ice cream, but you got to pour some cod liver oil on top. And the job as the leader is to make sure you're getting the right balance between that. If you have all the cod liver oil side, that's not going to be an innovative organization. If on the other hand, if you're just focusing on the ice cream side, you're not going to be innovative. It's that balance. And that's the balance to be obsessed with.
You're kind of like the bad cop of innovation here in this thing, right? Do you enjoy this role?
I enjoy the role of maybe just being truthful about it. Or what I perceive as truthful about it. You're right, though. I'm not the one who comes in and says, this is all going to be great and fun, that there's a tough side. And so what I advise companies is before you go down this path, just make sure everybody has signed up for it as a senior team. And are you ready to do this? Because if you start to go down the path of saying it's kind of all fun and games, and then reality set in, like, well, we do have to kill projects. We have to have a willingness to experiment, but we also have to be disciplined. If that's clear up front, that there's that paradox that has to be managed, I think you're in much better shape than later you start killing projects and people say, oh, well, they weren't serious at all about willingness to experiment. Because then, again, you start getting jaded.
Well, Gary, this has been really interesting. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's Gary Pisano. He's a professor at Harvard Business School, and his new book is Creative Construction. He's also the author of the article, The Hard Truth About Innovative Cultures. You can find it in the January-February 2019 issue of Harvard Business Review. This episode was produced by Mary Dew. We got technical help from Rob Eckhart. Adam Buchholz is our audio product manager. Thanks for listening to the HBR IdeaCast. I'm Kurt Nikisch.